At Arizona State University, we've made online education better, smarter, and more personalized so you can go further in your aspiring field.
I decided to pursue medicine once I realized that ASU did have the online program for biological sciences. You're still required to learn the same curriculum. You're still being tested on the same content that anyone would be tested on in person. The comprehensiveness of the program prepared me so well for medical school.
Explore over 350 plus programs at asuonline.asu.edu.
From Dallas, Texas, the flash, apparently official, President Kennedy died at 1 p.m. Central Standard Time.
Welcome to the End of Innocence. I'm your host, John Young. Wow, what a weekend it was last weekend in Dallas for the 62nd anniversary of the assassination. I met so many of our podcast listeners and subscribers, and had a blast on all the tours that we conducted over the weekend. Some of you were seeing Dealey Plaza for the first time. It was neat seeing your reactions to all the places we'd went, played such a huge part in that weekend back in November 63. I want to give a special shout out today to the Meeker boys, Dan, Jeff, and Landon. This weekend they gifted me with a Bell & Howell 8mm camera, just like the one that Abraham Zapruder used to film the murder of John F. Kennedy. Thank you so much for the gift, guys. Also, a huge shout out to all of you that came from all over the world to meet up with me in Dallas this past weekend. I truly remain humbled and thankful that you enjoy the podcast and my book, The End of Innocence. The search for the truth in the JFK assassination marches on because of folks like yourself. Those of you that have not purchased my book yet and would like to learn more about the assassination, drop me an email at endofinnocencejfk@gmail.com and I will get you a personalized signed copy in the mail. It would make a great gift for anyone interested in the JFK assassination. It is an oversized coffee table style book that is over 500 pages and contains hundreds of pictures, most of them in vibrant color. I can promise you will not be disappointed in the book. The price is $60 for the hardcover and $40 for the softcover. Now on to this week's episode. After 36 years of exhaustive research, writing a book on the assassination, and interviewing hundreds of witnesses, one question still looms large. Did Lee Harvey Oswald kill President John F. Kennedy? My answer to that question is a resounding no. To even ask who killed Kennedy, if not Oswald, is to entertain the possibility of conspiracy. But after decades of studying the evidence, I can't ignore what we've uncovered. Here's a brief overview of why I believe Oswald was not the assassin. No credible eyewitnesses placed Oswald on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository at the time of the shooting. Warren Report's case for placing Lee Harvey Oswald on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository at 12:30 rests heavily on one man, pipefitter Howard Brennan. Brennan claimed he saw a figure in the southeast corner window of the sixth floor shortly before the shots were fired. He described the man as a slender white male, about 5'10", with dark hair, aged 25 to 35. After the first shot, Brennan insisted he saw the same man with a rifle calmly taking aim and firing again. Yet a close look at the Zapruder film, when the first shots are fired, shows Brennan looking down Elm Street toward President Kennedy's direction, not up at the sixth floor window of the Texas School Book Depository building. Also, when presented with Oswald in a police lineup that very evening, Brennan faltered. His words were telling. He said, quote, "He looks like the man, but I can't say for sure," end quote. In other words, the one witness who supposedly saw the assassin in action could not positively identify Oswald when given the chance. Defenders of the Warren Report argue Brennan withheld his identification out of fear for his safety. But this explanation is speculative and rests on Brennan's later claim to the Warren Commission that he could have identified Oswald that night. Such retrospective confidence does not erase the fact that, in the moment, he failed to make the identification. Moreover, Brennan's vantage point raises serious doubts. He was standing six stories below, looking up at a half-closed window. The shooter would likely have been crouched or leaning forward, with only part of his body visible. Under those conditions, how reliable could Brennan's impression of the man's face truly be? The Warren report leans on Brennan because he is the only witness who explicitly places Oswald with the rifle in the window. But the fragility of his testimony, an uncertain lineup identification, and a difficult viewing angle makes him a shaky foundation for such a critical claim. If Brennan's account lapses under scrutiny, so too does the report's attempt to firmly anchor Oswald on the sixth floor at 12:30. Buell Wesley Frazier's account of Oswald bringing in a rifle into the building is riddled with inconsistencies, wrong dimensions, and no corroborating witnesses.
My sister and I, we went, as I said, my sister, Miss Lady Mae Frazier Randall, they arranged for us to come to Washington, D.C. to testify for the Warren Commission. We both testified, and during my testimony, they would ask me things, and they would try to get me to change my testimony to what they wanted. And when I would not do this, now here's the catcher. Listen to this real well. They said, oh, he doesn't know. He's just mistaken. Well, that to me, it just said, you just soon to punch me in the face, because I've never forgotten that. And I read some of their comments. How can someone that wasn't even there know all the answers? I don't know all the answers, and I don't know anybody does. But when someone, you testify before somebody and you tell them the truth and they don't like your answer, oh, he's mistaken, he just doesn't know.
But they were trying to get you to explain why you didn't notice the gun in the back of the car.
Because there was no gun. That's what they wouldn't buy. The police department here in Dallas didn't do it, and neither did they.
Medical evidence contradicts the lone gunman theory, challenging both the rear entry wound narrative and the Warren Commission's single bullet theory.
The location of the head wound is key evidence. Since a bullet almost always makes a small wound when it enters and a large wound when it exits, a big wound at the back of JFK's head would indicate a shot from the front, and more than one shooter. Most of the doctors and nurses who treated the president at Parkland did see a large wound at the rear of the head. Dr. Robert McClelland.
It was in the right back part of the head, very large.
Nurse Audrey Bell.
In all, there was a massive wound at the back of his head.
Dr. Charles Carrico.
There was a large defect about here on his skull.
Dr. Ronald Jones.
Well, my impression was that there was a wound in this area of the head, right in this area.
The Dallas doctor's recollections about an exit wound in the back of the president's head are confirmed by witnesses at the Bethesda Hospital autopsy.
I mean, a big gaping hole in the back of the head.
Floyd Reby, a photographer on duty, talked with Wayne Friedman.
So it's like somebody put a piece of dynamite in a tin can and light it off. There was nothing there.
Open area all the way across into the rear of the brain like that.
From the top of the head almost back to near the base of the skull. You could see where that part was gone.
So eyewitnesses in Dallas and Bethesda describe a wound extending all the way to the back of the head. What about the official photos and x-rays? We showed them to the three eyewitnesses to JFK's autopsy. Photos and x-rays not available to the public since the assassination, but recently obtained by the press. Gerald Custer took the x-rays that night.
Is this the x-ray picture that you took, and is this the wound that you saw on the president?
This area here was gone.
Not this area.
Not this area.
Floyd Reby assisted with the autopsy photos.
The two pictures that I've seen that you showed me that are supposedly from the archives are not what I saw that night. And I don't know where those pictures came from.
The back of the head looked like that? What did the back of the head look like?
It had a big hole in it. This whole area was gone.
Does that look like what you saw?
No, it doesn't look like what I saw. This would be a lesser of a wound than what I saw. I saw a lot worse wound that extended way back into this area here.
Was the president's hair and scalp like that?
No.
What was it like?
This part of the head was gone. There was no scalp there.
Are you telling me that this is not?
I don't believe so.
You don't think this is an honest-to-God autopsy photo?
No, I don't.
What do you think it is?
I don't know.
It's being phonied someplace. It's make-believe.
Before each doctor looked at the photos, he described the wounds he had seen back in 1963.
I could see the president's head wound quite well, and I was probably looking into a wound that was on the lateral or the side part of the head and the back part of the head.
It would be this portion of the head right here.
As I remember, it's like this.
However, a surviving clip of Dr. Perry recorded not long after the press conference.
Arriving at the emergency room, Dr. Carathway placed a tube in the president's trachea to assist his breathing. But there was a neck wound anteriorly and a large wound in his head, right posterior area.
Oswald lacked recent rifle practice, and his Marine marksmanship scores were unimpressive to say the least. Lee Oswald served in the Marines several years before the JFK assassination and had been trained and tested in rifle shooting. The Warren Commission needed to show that he was a better marksman than the experts from the U.S. Army and the FBI. In the late 1950s, U.S. Marines were categorized at three levels of shooting ability according to the scores they achieved at a standardized test of their accuracy. To be an expert, you had to score between 220 to 250. To be a sharpshooter, your score had to be between 210 and 219. And to just be an average marksman, your score had to be 190 to 209. According to his Marine scorecard, Oswald was tested twice. In December 1956, after a very intense 3 weeks training period, Oswald scored 212, two marks above the minimum for a sharpshooter. But in May 1959, he scored 191, which is only one mark above the minimum for a marksman and only 1 point higher than the bottom of the scale. Lieutenant Colonel Allison Folsom testified to the Warren Commission to interpret Oswald's Marine records. He said that Oswald's score of 191 was, quote, low marksmanship rating and showed that he was a rather poor shot, end quote. So Oswald's Marine Corps rifle accuracy test demonstrated that he was towards the lower end of the scale, though he did pass the test both times. But what did Oswald's fellow Marines think of him as a shooter? Nelson Delgado met Oswald in the Marines around Christmas of 1958. He considers himself to have been one of Oswald's closest friends in the Marines. Delgado said that at the range, Oswald would hit 2 out of 10 usually. Sometimes Oswald would miss completely, which is called Maggie's drawers, and it is noted by a red flag in that shooter's lane. Delgado described Oswald's shooting skills in more detail when he talked to Mark Lane back in 1967.
This is an interview with Sergeant Nelson Delgado, who served in the Marine Corps with Lee Harvey Oswald. Sergeant Delgado appeared as a witness before the Warren Commission. Sergeant, prior to your Warren Commission testimony, were you interviewed by agents of the FBI?
Yes, they came to my home in South Jersey to interview me. First two visits, they came just to get my story, what I knew about Oswald, how close we were, and things like that. After that, then they started, the questions were tending to break my story down.
Sergeant, where are you now stationed?
Down in one of the missile sites in South Jersey. Have been there since prior to the assassination of Kennedy. I've been here now for 3 years, and this month, the 20th to be exact, I'm leaving for Vietnam.
When did you first meet Oswald?
Just prior to the Christmas of 1958, Oswald reported into our unit. Oswald and I got along very good together. We were, like I said, working the same jobs. Involving aircrafts and radar, we controlled them from the ground and ran intercepts. We were about 40 enlisted men that really participated in this job. All of us knew Lee, and he knew all of us. We got along fine. We had discussions.
Was Oswald interested in guns?
They say he was a gun enthusiast, but I recall many instances where we stood inspections, and he was constantly being gigged for having a dirty weapon and then taking improper care of his weapon. He was always reminded when he had to clean the weapon. Never took it upon himself to do so.
Do you have personal knowledge of Oswald's ability
with a rifle.
At the range, he couldn't prove by me that he was a good shot. As any person who's ever served in the armed forces could tell you, there's a part in the qualification that calls for rapid firing. This is done with 10 shots, 8 in a clip and 2 that you load by hand. They give you maybe 45 seconds to be exact to fire these 10 rounds. Well, when you fire these, then you stand away from your firing position until everyone has finished firing. Then the targets are brought down and scored. The targets are run back up, and they're disced for the number that you have hit, 5s, 4s, 3s, or misses. Well, in Oswald's particular case, it was quite funny to look at, because he would get a couple of discs. Maybe out of the possible 10, he'll get 2 or 3 Maggie's drawers. Now, these are a red flag that's on a long pole, and this is running from left to right on the target itself. And you don't see this on the firing line too often, not the Marine firing line. And it's, you can't help but notice it when you're seeing discs around some of the things coming up and down, and farther on down the line, you see a flag waving. Well, that was going to catch your eye anyway. And we thought it was funny that Oswald's was getting these Maggie's drawers so rapidly, one after the other. And this is why I can't say, think that he could be a good shot, because a good shot doesn't pull this. He'll pull a 3, but he won't pull a Maggie's drawer. It's a complete miss.
How did the FBI react to your statement that Oswald was a poor shot?
They tried to disprove this. They did not like the idea when I came up with the statement that Oswald, as far as I knew, Oswald was a very poor shot.
Do you feel that the agents of the FBI actually tried to get you to change your statement that Oswald was a poor shot?
Yes, sir, I definitely do.
Sherman Cooley also met Oswald in the military. Cooley said, quote, "If I had to pick one man in the whole United States to shoot me, I'd pick Lee Harvey Oswald. I saw the man shoot. There is no way he could have ever learned to shoot well enough to do what they accused him of doing in Dallas," end quote. Another military cohort of Oswald was James Persons. Persons said Oswald had below average coordination, which he thought was a major factor in Oswald's very poor marksmanship. So it's safe to say that at least some of Oswald's military peers had doubts about his ability to pull off the assassination. During his test in the Marines, Oswald had used presumably a good to excellent rifle. The Mimical Carcano rifle that was discovered on the sixth floor of the Texas School Book Depository, however, was a cheap old weapon. It was examined by the FBI's firearm specialist, who stated that, quote, "Every time we changed the adjusting screws to move the crosshairs in the telescopic sight in one direction, it also affected the movement of the impact or the point of impact in the other direction. We fired several shots and found that the shots were not all landing in the same place, but were gradually moving away from the point of impact," end quote.
The timeline of Officer J.D. Tippett's murder makes Oswald's involvement logistically impossible.
Now, another problem with the Tippett case was the timing, all right? And what I mean by that is that the Warren Commission said that Oswald, after the shooting of Kennedy, left work, was driven by a taxi to his rooming house in Oak Cliff, that he was only at the rooming house for a short period of time, that he picked up his revolver and walked outside and went to a corner across the street. That corner, by the way, accommodates a bus line that if you get on board the bus, goes the wrong way from 10th and Peyton, which is the scene of the Tippett shooting. But anyway, that's the last time the landlady saw him. And she said that he was there at about 1:04. All right. Well, the Warren Commission tells us that Oswald then walked from that corner to 10th and Peyton, and Tippett was killed at about 1:15. And, of course, they say Oswald did it. Now, the problem with this is a distance of about 9/10 of a mile, and that creates a problem because it's hard to believe somebody can walk 9/10 of a mile in something like 11 minutes. And by the way, and I know two researchers who did walk that route, and they were both much taller than Oswald. And they said, you know, we power walked it. You know, we didn't just normally walk it because we didn't come close to 11 minutes. All right. So this begins to be a problem. The time of 1:15 for the shooting of Oswald is simply not supported by the weight of the evidence. All right, there's several witnesses like Mrs. Donald Higgins and, for example, Helen Markham, Roger Craig, T.F. Bowley, who all say that the shooting occurred a few minutes before that. And for example, T.F. Bowley had a watch on. Roger Craig had a watch on. These witnesses placed the shooting of Tippit much closer to about 106 or 107, you know. Now, the problem with that, of course, is that if it's hard to believe Oswald could have got to the Tippit shooting at 115, it's simply not possible to believe that he could have got there at 107.
Oswald declared himself a patsy and made a mysterious jailhouse call to a man in Raleigh, North Carolina, with military intelligence ties, an act never fully explained.
One statement, please.
I'd like some legal representation. These police officers have not allowed me to have any. I don't know what this is all about.
You killed the president. Black eye.
No, sir, I didn't. People
How'd
keep asking me that.
Sir? Did you shoot the president?
I work in that building.
Were you in the building at the time?
Naturally, if I work in that building, yes, sir.
Back up, man.
Did you shoot the president?
No, they're taking me in because of the fact that I live in the Soviet
Union.
I'm just a patsy.
Did you shoot the president?
It was Saturday night, November 23, 1963, and Elvita Treon arrived for her shift at the telephone switchboard of the Dallas Municipal Building. Treon would relieve her co-worker, Lewis Sweeney, who had been given orders by their supervisor to assist two men in listening to a call that would come through their switchboard. Treon assumed the men were Secret Service. She suspected that Lee Harvey Oswald, the accused assassin, being held in a downstairs jail, would be making another call. He had already phoned his Russian wife Marina and an ACLU lawyer in New York. This call, however, was different. Oswald rang the switchboard at 10:45 p.m. Sweeney took the call and scribbled Oswald's information as the two men listened in. Treon would go on to say, quote, "I listened and watched very carefully for Mrs. Sweeney to place the call with the long-distance operator. I heard her repeat a number to the caller and saw her write down details on a notation pad, which is a normal routine. She appeared very nervous and visibly shaken. For a few minutes, she just sat there trembling." Quote, "I was dumbfounded at what happened next," Treon later told a former Senate investigator. Quote, "Sweeney told Oswald, 'I'm sorry, the number doesn't answer,'" end quote. Mrs. Treon would later say that her lasting impression of the events that night is that Mrs. Sweeney had been instructed by someone to not put the call through to Oswald. Sweeney then unplugged and disconnected Oswald without ever really trying to put the call through. Afterward, Sweeney tore the sheet from her notepad and threw it into the trash. She left, her shift having ended. Treon retrieved the wadded piece of paper from the trash and copied the information onto a standard long-distance telephone call slip to save as a souvenir. The slip reveals that Oswald had given Treon the name John Hurt of Raleigh, North Carolina. It was through the work of independent researcher Michael Canfield that a copy of the Raleigh call slip first became public. He secured a copy of the slip, which became available as a result of a Freedom of Information lawsuit filed by a civil rights activist while conducting research for the 1975 book Coup d'etat in America. The book was the first major work to deal with the Raleigh phone call, and the slip was reprinted in the appendix. On the slip were two numbers attributed to a John Hurt, one for a John W. Hurt and one for a John D. Hurt. Canfield called both numbers. John W. Hurt turned up nothing of interest. However, when Canfield spoke to John D. Hurt, he sat stunned, silent when Hurt revealed, quote, "I was in the counterintelligence corps in the Army during World War II, end quote. The fact that Oswald called a former military intelligence officer from jail, only to be assassinated by Jack Ruby a little more than 12 hours later, was notable, and to that point, publicly undisclosed. Victor Marchetti was a 14-year veteran of the CIA, who had served as an executive assistant to then-Deputy Director Richard Helms. Marchetti had also written extensively about the Raleigh call in the book The CIA and the Cult of Intelligence. It was the first book on the assassination censored by the U.S. government. In an interview, Marchetti stated that in calling Hurt, Oswald was clearly following standard procedure for a CIA asset under duress.
This includes contacting his case officer through a cutout, an intermediary with no direct involvement in an operation. Marchetti would go on to say Oswald was probably calling his cutout. He was calling somebody who could put him in touch with the case officer. He couldn't go beyond that person. There's no way he could. He just had to depend on this person to say, okay, I'll deliver the message. Now, if the cutout had already been alerted to cut him off and ignore him, then, oh well, Oswald was out of luck. And this was likely what happened, Marchetti said. Now, let's just stop and think about that for a minute. Oswald uses one of his precious phone calls while in jail to reach out to some random guy who just happens to have a background in military intelligence? Oh, come on. What has come to be dubbed the Raleigh call went unrecorded in the Warren Commission investigation? Imagine that. And after all these years, little has come of this story, and mysteries surrounding the call have contributed to assassination conspiracy theories. The details about this phone call have been called by G. Robert Blakely, who was chief counsel for the House Select Committee on Assassinations, as real, substantiated, and very troublesome, and deeply disturbing. He went on to say that while this is only a small part of the larger mystery of the Kennedy assassination, it raises questions that remain unanswered, makes inferences which are ultimately inconclusive, and therefore an unanswerable mystery. Jack Ruby didn't just stumble into the police garage that morning to kill Oswald. He stalked Oswald all weekend long, and even warned police he might kill him if they didn't alter their plans.
Jack Ruby was obviously stalking Oswald after the assassination. He was in the midnight press conference where Oswald is asked questions and for the first time is informed that he is a suspect in the assassination of JFK. Seth Kanner mentions that Ruby was, you know, showed up at Parkland Hospital. There were some weird phone calls that the Dallas police got the night before the assassination, suggesting you better not move Oswald. There's a good chance that Ruby might have been that guy.
Then I suddenly realized, you know, knowing Jack Ruby the way I did, this was the man I was talking to on the phone last night.
I mean, Ruby's in a position, it seems, that, as I said, that he's tracking Oswald after the assassination.
Beyond the assassination itself, Oswald's life is filled with anomalies. He was reportedly seen in two places at once, a pattern dating back to his teenage years and continuing through his time in the Marines. Evidence suggests Oswald was recruited by the CIA, serving as a radar operator for the U-2 spy program in Japan. His medical discharge was a ruse, orchestrated with help from his mother. He applied to the Albert Schweitzer College, a school allegedly funded by a CIA conduit. His defection to the Soviet Union appears staged, part of a CIA-KGB mole hunt, confirmed by legendary CIA officer Pete Bagley. In New Orleans, Oswald worked with Guy Bannister, attempting to infiltrate leftist groups, likely as part of a broader setup. Oswald's trip to Mexico City remains murky, with strong evidence of impersonation. In Dallas, Oswald was befriended by CIA asset George de Morningshield, under orders from the field CIA chief Jay Walton. Ruth Payne, whose family had CIA ties, inserted herself into Marina Oswald's life under questionable pretenses. Oswald was impersonated repeatedly in 1963, documented in dozens of instances, partly the behavior surrounding a so-called lone nut. Who impersonates someone unless there's something to be gained, or unless they're being paid to do it? If Lee Harvey Oswald didn't kill President Kennedy, then the question becomes, who did? This isn't just speculation. It's a necessary inquiry grounded in decades of evidence, contradictions, and deliberate misdirection. The official narrative has long pointed to a lone gunman, but the deeper you dig, the more that story unravels. In the episodes ahead, we begin our investigation into the individuals and organizations that may have played a role in the assassination. We'll examine key figures in Dallas law enforcement and local politics, whose actions raise serious questions about complicity or foreknowledge. We'll also look at the intelligence community's fingerprints on Oswald's movements and associations. We'll take a look at the role of anti-Castro Cuban exiles, many of whom had deep ties to U.S. intelligence and a motive rooted in betrayal. We'll also look at the shadowy network of organized crime, which had both the means and motive to silence Kennedy. Each of these threads leads us closer to understanding not just who pulled the trigger, but who orchestrated the cover-up and why. Join me as we peel back the layers of deception and follow the evidence wherever it leads. The truth didn't die in Dealey Plaza. It's waiting to be uncovered. We'll see you next episode when we start to take a look at one of those shadowy figures in the Dallas police. We take a look at Roscoe White. We'll see you then.
Have you ever had a moment where you think, man, someone should really do something about this? Then you realize maybe that someone is you. Well, with the help of GoFundMe, you can change someone's life. You could start a GoFundMe to help a friend pay for school, fund that new community space, or help a local kid finally get to that national competition. I've seen this myself. Last year, a friend of mine launched a GoFundMe to help with medical bills after an unexpected surgery. It was incredible how fast the support rolled in. People want to help. They just need a way to do it. And GoFundMe makes it easy. So, do you have a dream, a person, or a cause in your life that could use some support? Don't wait for someone else to bring change. You can be the one who makes a difference. GoFundMe is the world's number one fundraising platform, trusted by over 200 million people. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com.
Menards Black Friday sale is here. Get everything you need to bring home the holidays. A Nerf Blaster dog toy blasts tennis balls 75 feet. Fun for you and your pup. Just $15.99. Delicious Dubai chocolate is $12.99 a bag. Color-changing squish lamps and Performax drill bit sets are only $4.99 each. Menards has great Black Friday gifts for everyone in your family. Hurry in while supplies last. Good through November 30th. See Menards.com for details.